to tell their stories about becoming a medical teacher, how they got there, and what keeps them going. I'm your co-host, Debbie Basco. I'm a faculty development associate in the Vancouver Fraser Medical Program, as well as a hospitalist physician at Burnaby Hospital. I'm joined by my co-host, Derek.
Hi, I'm your co-host, Derek Chang, an addiction and family physician in Vancouver. At this time, I'm a fellow at the Center for Health Education Scholarship at UBC Medicine. Before we begin, we would like to acknowledge that we are gathered on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people, through which we have the privilege of working and residing on these lands. So today we have the pleasure to have Dr. Sharon Bibler with us. So Sharon is the medical director of Fraser Health Addiction Medicine and Substance Use Services, and also a clinical associate professor with the Department of Family Practice at UBC. She works with a variety of learners from medical students, residents, to fellows. And personally, she was my preceptor when I was going through my addiction medicine training, and so she's a special guest. So today, Sharon has joined us to share a bit about her journey to become an educator and how she has discovered the power of storytelling and used storytelling in her teaching. So welcome, Sharon.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why is storytelling so powerful in your learning and teaching in medical education?
It's the context in which we move through our work. Without the stories, without our understanding the context of our patients, every patient would look the same. You know, every patient with OUD would just be patient X with OUD or opioid use disorder. Every patient with an appendicitis would be patient Y with appendicitis. It's the context, it's the variables, it's the stories that allows us to practice the art of medicine and allows us to still be challenged. It allows me to never, ever be bored when I'm working clinically. It's the color to the work that we do.
Yeah, I like how the story really kind of adds that, the context, and also with the part of the art of medicine. I think as I also work in addiction medicine, and sometimes addiction medicine can be a tough place to work. I wonder, could you share maybe an example of how storytelling can help with maybe with the clinical work or with your teaching with your learners?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. it can be a tough space to exist within and alongside. For me, I think the storytelling piece allows us that wider lens. I think as physicians or as healthcare providers, we love figuring out the right answer based on what we've read in a textbook. And we want to be able to make those recommendations to a patient and say, well, it's simple. You have this disorder, you should take this medicine. And when you take that approach and perhaps repeatedly your patient returns and you haven't fixed the problem just with the medicine, it can be defeating. And what storytelling allows, at least for me, and I think for many of my colleagues, is what is the story around the medicine? And so, you know, early on in practice, I may have believed, well, clearly this medicine, quote unquote, does not work. And now when I think about storytelling, it's asking my patients, tell me your story. So one of the most important questions I encourage my residents to ask is, tell me how you got to clinic today. So when they're seeing a patient, having that as part of the first few questions. How did you get here today? What's it like to get to the pharmacy every day? What's it like to pay for your medications? What are those pieces? What role do those pieces play in stabilizing their medical condition? Because it could be as easy as me saying, here's the medicine, you have to take it, with my privileged lens and not understanding the take it part for many of my patients is so much more nuanced. So you shift your lens as a provider. And maybe you use that information for advocacy or even for navigating, okay, it sounds like the medicine actually is helpful when you can take it. But what I'm hearing is getting to the pharmacy every day is tough because that's the story piece. So how do we address that part? How do we address the getting to the medicine? So pieces like that, it just subtly shifts the way you look at A, your own performance as a physician, because many of us have our egos intricately tied into that, but also how you look at your patient and the assumptions that you're making.
Sharon, I feel like when you're teaching your learners, they must get a sense of your extreme fundamental empathy towards all people, not just people who can drive to the clinic and pay for their medications and take them like a good patient. Have you noticed over the course of your career as a physician and as a teacher, have you noticed an improvement in empathy in your learners and in society in general? Or do you think we still have a long way to go in terms of empathy towards the addictions population?
Depends what day you ask me that question. In general, I have absolutely recognized learners coming in with higher levels of capacity for empathy and with the ability to demonstrate empathy. I think a lot of that has to do with awareness. I think you need to be aware of situations in order to feel empathy or to recognize what deserves your empathy. And I think with each passing cohort, we have residents and medical students and fellows that are just more aware than the last cohort, certainly far more aware than I was at that stage of training about truly what the social determinants of health are. And I'm quite delighted to see that many of the learners coming through already have a cognitive concept around that. And so I do have hope. I think we are absolutely headed in the right direction. I don't think we're there across the board, but the questions I get asked in the last few years look very different than the questions I was being asked 10 years ago. And what it shows me is there's a thread of empathy that's in medical education.
And possibly the learners themselves are a bit more diverse than they were a generation ago. That's my observation anyways.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I really like that, what you're saying about that, the thread of empathy.
And I think that we are moving towards a more healthy self-examination. I think we're asking ourselves questions about power and privilege and recognizing the roles that power and privilege play and how that may be why you're on one side of that exam table as opposed to the other. In this patient population, I think they probably come up in a number of patient populations and patient encounters, but there's an openness to exploring that, which again, I think is increasing year after year, that I see in the students and the learners.
Yes, you notice that increasing awareness among your learners. Do you have a story that comes to your mind?
I would say not uncommonly. I will have learners still ask about why do people choose to stay homeless? So situations where perhaps shelters are offered to patients. So in a hospital setting or when we're figuring out disposition following a withdrawal management stay and a patient will decline a referral to a shelter bed, or situations in which learners will ask, why would you continue to use when you know the risk of overdose in the context of the toxic drug supply? So A, I think it's telling that people are comfortable asking these questions in these settings rather than just coming to a conclusion on their own. So I actually love those opportunities and those conversations and feel honored that they would ask. And we explore the answers. So exploring those kind of conversations, I think, can really shift the perspective of a learner. And it also, I think it empowers them to engage in those conversations with our patient population. And what my experience has been is our patients truly appreciate being asked, because what it does in that moment is it says, I see you and I'm wondering about your story. And it's that human moment, right? We're just humans taking care of other humans, which sometimes we like to push aside because it can feel heavy and big. But those are those moments I actually think that protect us from burnout, right? That it's no longer another number, another person. It's about this individual and the idea of it's hard to judge a choice an individual makes if you don't know what they're choosing between. So that opportunity to explore that is humanizing. And I think that's a big part of what we need to be doing.
I can definitely count myself as someone who might have been guilty of not understanding why we're working so hard to get you this shelter. Why would you just leave? Why would you say no? And now I get it a lot more. And I think part of it comes from listening to the stories and understanding that people with opioid addictions are not all the same. That's just one small facet of their life. It's a big part right now, but it's certainly nowhere near everything that they are. And hearing about childhood, where you came from, what you want, what your dreams were growing up, and that can very much humanize the interaction and makes us feel this common humanity, because we all have as much in common with each other as we have differences.
Absolutely.
So I always like to establish that kind of rapport where we find things that we have in common, whether it's a sense of humor or a kind of music. There's always something that we have in common.
Yeah. And one of the prompts that I have some of my learners try is, we're so accustomed to taking a history the way we were taught. You know, you've got history presenting illness, and then we go through and we check box, like, okay, social history, this history, that history, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes we forget to listen because we're so busy filling in the blanks of our needs, because we're going to, you know, dictate the consult or what have you. And there is a place for that. And once you develop a rhythm around that, you can push it aside a bit, and you can have conversations that start like, tell me your story. And one piece that I often say is, tell me more. What you'll find is your patients will identify all the stuff that's important. And usually by the end of it, you've actually got all the information you need. And if you haven't, you have a more organic way of getting to it. So you have this kind of background information to allow for a more natural conversation, which can be helpful in building rapport. And again, it's this like gentle signaling, I see you as a human being. One of the questions I get around that not infrequently from learners is, doesn't that take so much longer? Right, which is not an uncommon fear in medicine, and I hold it as well. and no, it doesn't. So what we need to do is trust ourselves to be able to pick out the salient pieces of information, because we're actually really good at that. I just don't know if we trust ourselves to do it without our little checklist that we're so used to going through. And for me, and I think for many of our learners, is stories help us remember.
Yeah, I listened to you, Sharon. I do remember when I was a resident, and when we went to see patients together, I do remember you just say a lot, tell me more, tell me more. And then the patient would just tell the story or learn different things. And then also like just how I learned so much about, for example, I did my like urban dictionary, right? Well, like beginning, I didn't know what Tina was.
Yep.
And I learned it was crystal meth. It was really, yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole vocabulary that you get to learn when you work in this area of medicine. It makes you feel a lot cooler than we actually are, but it's nice to be able to communicate with your patients as well.
I think seeing social determinants of health come to life right in front of you with your patients, you realize that you're only one person and you have the patient in front of you to help. But there's this sense that you also want to really impact these determinants in a really major way. And I think teaching the next generation of learners is the best way to exponentially get more advocates for these. And advocacy is one of the CanMed's competencies. So that should be part of our teaching. How do you manage, do you on a personal level have any ideas of how to best bang for a buck to improve these social determinants of health? And how do you impart that to your learners?
Yeah. And this is the piece that sometimes can sit very heavy, that like that, you know, that first moment where you realize I actually have a scope of influence that's smaller than I thought. The conversations that I have with my learners, one is if they come back, if a learner comes back and shares a case with me that's difficult, I ask them, do you feel uncomfortable? And they will say yes. And I say, good. Does this make you sad? And they say yes. And I say, good. And not in a, you know, fantastic, I like your discomfort and your sadness, but good, because you're a human. And these stories should never stop making us sad and stop making us uncomfortable. The day you can move through this space without feeling sad and uncomfortable is maybe the day you take a vacation or, you know, take a pause. So I do that to validate that response. I don't think it's something we explore too much in our training. The human piece and the human responses we have in those situations. And what you can see many of us do is engage in an action bias. When you feel a little bit yucky in a situation, you think, okay, what am I going to do? Let's prescribe something. You know, what are the tools I have? I have a prescription pad. I have a document that I can, like, you know, some kind of thing that I can fill out. And sometimes that action isn't what's necessary, but just that space. You can sit there with your patient and say, that sounds really tough. And you can sit with yourself and think, I don't know if this is fair. I don't know if the world is as beautiful as I thought it was. You know, there are moments that are beautiful and there are moments that aren't.
So as we're moving to kind of the last part of our conversation today, since we're talking about experience of teaching and learning, could you share with us a memorable story, whether when you were a learner or when you were a teacher?
Yeah, I was actually thinking about this over the last little while. So my family practice preceptor was amazing. So his name is Dr. Mike Allen, and I did residency at the University of Alberta. And I tried to pinpoint why I had such a good experience. I realized it was I never felt uncomfortable around this preceptor. He has a wicked sense of humor. So there was a lot of laughter. There was a lot of camaraderie, and there was an ease in which I could ask questions and explore my role as, you know, resident and then kind of developing into staff. I think what I've tried to emulate is that feeling of ease when my learners come and rotate through with me. I want them to get the sense that they absolutely should be here, that their presence is desired, and that we're happy that they're here and that they are seen as our future colleagues. And I think that was the sense that I got throughout my training with Dr. Allen, that this really was a colleague that I was going to have in a few short years. And what that allows is for you to be a little bit bolder with your learning and your experiences and what you're going to try and what you're going to offer. So that was my personal experience.
Sharon, I wonder if you have maybe a final message or a piece of advice to leave with listeners who are thinking about or currently teaching medical learners?
Yeah, I think one piece that I spend a lot of time chatting with my group of physicians is how we measure ourselves as teachers. And what I note is we'll often take a lot of pride in our teaching ability with the brightest and most capable residents. And sometimes I'll be working with preceptors in my department and they will say, oh, this resident made this mistake or made that mistake or repeatedly did this. And my question is, what did that conversation look like? How did you guide them? Not infrequently, that conversation has not been had. And so sometimes we slide into being supervisors instead of teachers. And so just reminding ourselves that we're not just there to observe and supervise, we're actually meant to guide. We should be measuring ourselves with the learners that come in and maybe they don't get it right away. Can you figure out a way to make them better at a skill or better at a strategy than they were 2 weeks ago when they started? Because that's how you measure yourself as a teacher. And again, I am not always successful at this, but it is a good reminder for me. And it's a conversation I have with a number of my teaching colleagues that there is a difference between supervision and teaching, and we're here to teach. So that's probably the most common message. And I think one that will really help serve us in our teaching journeys.
That's amazing advice.
All right. Well, thank you, Sharon. Thank you for sharing your journey, your stories.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, you guys. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Sharon. Your patients and your learners are very lucky to have you.
Oh, thanks. And I them.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to hear more from the Magicator podcast, please check us out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and whenever you get your podcasts. Stay healthy and safe, and we hope to see you next time.
Enjoying UBC Medicine Learning Network presents on CITR? Check out the entire family of podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Audible. Join the conversation and our community on social media. Follow at UBC MedVid on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, TikTok, Facebook, and LinkedIn. That's UBC MedVid.
This podcast was recorded on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
To learn more about the land you are on, visit native-land.ca. Hello and welcome to Women's Health Interrupted,
a Women's Health Research Cluster podcast.
I'm Rebecca Barron.
And I'm Sydney Clips. Through scientific inquiry and storytelling, this podcast brings you content about women's health from many angles.
Dr. Gordon is a tireless advocate for breast cancer screening starting at age 40 and for women with dense breasts. She is a clinical professor in the Department of Radiology at the University of British Columbia and wants women to have accurate, current information that will allow them to make informed decisions about their screening. Dr. Gordon works alongside Jenny Dale as the medical advisor of Dense Breast Canada. Jenny Dale is the executive director of Dense Breast Canada and was diagnosed with breast cancer in October 2014. Jenny co-founded this organization with Michelle in 2017 and has teamed up with breast cancer survivors nationwide to raise awareness of the risks of dense breasts. Together, over the past 4 years, they have successfully advocated for changes in policy in many Canadian provinces. We are so excited to be joined today by our speakers, Dr. Paula Gordon and Jenny Dale. Thank you both for being here with us. So, to start us off, what are dense breasts and why is breast density important?
Hi, everybody. I'm Paula Gordon. I'm a breast radiologist in Vancouver. The term dense breasts refers to the proportion of normal breast tissue to fat in a woman's breasts. Every woman has both fat and breast tissue, but some women have more of one or the other. So to simplify, if a woman's breasts have more than 50% fat, we call them non-dense. And if they have 50% or more normal breast tissue with less fat, we call them dense. It's normal to have dense breasts, and it's quite common. About 40% of women over the age of 40 have dense breasts. But there are risks to having dense breasts, the most important being that cancers can hide in normal dense tissue. That's because on a mammogram, fat is black and normal breast tissue is white. lumps, including cancers, are also white. And that's cancers and non-cancers, even cysts and non-cancerous lumps, et cetera. So if a woman has a lot of normal white tissue, it makes it hard, or in some cases impossible, to see a lump, even a cancer. The other concern about dense breasts is that women who have dense breasts are at a higher risk to get breast cancer than women who have non-dense breasts. So it's a perfect storm. They're at a higher risk to get breast cancer, and it's harder for us to see them on their mammograms. The only way to know if a woman has dense breasts is by looking at her mammogram. You can't tell by size, by feel, or even if the breasts feel lumpy. Lumpy breast tissue can be either fatty or dense. And because it's harder to see breast cancer on a mammogram of a woman with dense breasts, she doesn't have the same opportunity for early detection of breast cancer with mammography as a woman with non-dense breasts. If her cancer is not found early, she might need more aggressive treatment. And if her cancer is found late, she will not have as good a prognosis. Now, we know that we can find many of those missed cancers with other tests, including ultrasound. For women who've recently been diagnosed with breast cancer, it's important to know whether they have dense breasts, because it's possible that in addition to the cancer they know about, there might be other cancers in one or both breasts that we don't know about. So sometimes those women have an MRI to help the surgeon decide if they need more extensive surgery. Women who've had cancer and been treated are at a higher risk than average to get a second cancer in either breast. So after they've been treated, they may need better screening going forward to watch for any breast cancer recurrences or new cancers.
And what age should women start getting mammograms for breast cancer, and how often?
Ideally, all women should start having mammograms every year starting at age 40. Now, that's because we know that annual screening starting at 40 saves the most lives. Breast cancer is less common in younger women, but it still accounts for 17% of all breast cancers. And because these women are usually premenopausal and their ovaries are still making hormones, their cancers tend to grow faster than cancers in older women. Now, if these women don't have screening and their cancers aren't found early, their chances of survival are not as good, and they are more likely to need harsh treatment. For example, when a cancer is found small, a woman can have a small operation called a lumpectomy rather than need to have her whole breast removed. If her cancer is found early, she can have a less invasive test to check her lymph nodes than the traditional bigger armpit surgery. The larger surgery has a much higher rate of a complication called lymphedema. That's when the arm and hand on the side of the cancer become swollen. It's usually permanent, and for some women, it's the worst part of having breast cancer. Also, when cancer is found early, and if testing shows that it has a low risk of recurrence, many women can avoid chemotherapy. Now, minority women, especially Black, Asian, and Hispanic women, must absolutely be screened starting at age 40, because they're more likely to develop cancer at younger ages than white women. And also, of course, women 40 to 49 play multiple important roles. Many have toddlers at home. Some are helping look after aging parents, and many are working and contributing to the economy. They're not expendable. Now, in some provinces, BC, Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and Yukon, women can self-refer for mammography without a requisition starting at age 40, but other provinces start at 50. And even in provinces where women can't self-refer, they are able to get a requisition from their doctor, but it's not always easy. Now, if you don't know what's available in your province, please check out a brand new website, mybreastscreening.ca.
Absolutely. And we will have all of those resources and links in our show notes as well for our episode. So what should women who have learned they have dense breasts do in order to be more proactive?
Well, that's a good question. There's several things women with dense breasts can do. First, they should still have regular mammograms. And as I said, ideally starting at age 40 and as close as possible to annually. They should try to get additional screening, usually with ultrasound, but sometimes MRI, depending on what their other risks are, family history and so on. Now, if that's not available, please don't wait for someone else to fix the system. I'm going to say this over and over. Please advocate. That's how British Columbia got all women notified of their breast density and got screening breast ultrasound covered by our healthcare system. Dense Breast Canada, you're going to hear from Jenny shortly, when those women got involved, they worked energetically and persistently, and they made themselves heard by the people who can bring about positive change, and that's politicians. I always say politicians don't listen to doctors, but they listen to voters. And Jenny and her co-founder of Dense Breast Canada really did that work. So women should advocate. The other thing is they should do breast self-examination. In fact, that's not just women with dense breasts. All women should do breast self-examination. I know that term has fallen out of favor lately. And you'll sometimes hear that women should be breast aware, like aware of changes in their breasts. But you don't know if you've had a change unless you know what your normal breast texture feels like. And all women have texture, lumpiness, and so on in their breasts, which is unique to them. So a woman who does breast self-exam, even if she doesn't do it religiously and every month, will become more of an expert in what her normal breast tissue is than a healthcare provider like a nurse or a doctor. So younger women, premenopausal women, should try to do it when they're just finishing their period. That's when the breasts are least tender and least lumpy. But even if it's every couple of months, it's still important to do. Now, the other thing women can do is adjust their modifiable behaviors. For example, they should get to and stay at a healthy body weight. We know that obese women are more likely, or overweight women have higher estrogen levels. They're more likely to get breast cancer. Women should try to cut back on their alcohol intake. And that might be particularly important to say during the pandemic when alcohol consumption has increased. We know that alcohol basically is a carcinogen. There's no safe level. The more you drink, the higher risk of breast cancer and, in fact, other cancers. So cut back and think of it as a treat. It's not, you know, a glass of wine with dinner every night is not okay. Another thing women can do is exercise moderately. And the minimum is 150 minutes a week. Now that's 30 minutes five times a day, or you can cut it up into different chunks if you like, but moderate exercise reduces the risk of getting breast cancer. So that's everything women can with dense breasts can do to be proactive.
So what are your experiences like working at Dense Breast Canada, and how has this changed your own perspectives on breast cancer as well as other women's health issues?
Thank you for the question, Rebecca. There's a lot to talk about here. We're an awareness and advocacy organization, which Michelle DiTomaso and I co-founded about 5.5 years ago. And we're very grateful to have Dr. Gordon as our medical advisor. Michelle and I began Dense Breast Canada because we were shocked and appalled and angry that women in Canada were being denied information about their breast density and being denied a chance to be proactive about their breast health, and maybe even being denied a chance to have breast cancer detected earlier. So our first advocacy stand was that all women in Canada be directly informed of their breast density. And we've had some success with that. As mentioned, we now have 6 provinces informing all women of their breast density. And the other provinces have taken some form of action, but not enough. So the advocacy is continuing on that front. The modeling has shown that 400 lives a year are lost by not offering screening at 40. And if you add on an additional 300 lives that are lost by not offering ultrasound to women with dense breasts, that means over the past 10 years that we've had up to 7,000 Canadian women who have died needlessly. And that's a travesty. And learning things like this has totally changed my perspective. And I believe there's so much more that we can do, that we need to do in Canada to promote early detection of breast cancer and to save lives. And to do that, we need to ensure that optimal screening is provided across the country. So last year, Dense Breast Canada looked at the screening practices in each province, and we found differences across the country that we feel are resulting in significant inequities. And for us, it's like an early detection lottery by postal code. And we don't feel that it's right that where you live in Canada determines whether breast cancer will be found early or not. For example, if you live in BC, you can get screened at 40. In Alberta or Ontario, screening is at 50, unless you know to ask for a requisition, and most women don't know that. And if you live in BC, you're going to be told if you have dense breasts, and you're going to be able to access a screening ultrasound. But if you live in Ontario, only women with the highest category are being told. And if you live in Nova Scotia, you're going to be flat out denied a chance of getting an ultrasound. So we compared the provinces on what we consider to be optimal screening practices, six of them. And in Quebec, they offered 0 out of 6. In Yukon, 5 out of 6, and hopefully soon to be 6 out of 6. Most provinces scored about 3. So with so many disparities in screening across the country, we've got women confused, they're unclear about breast screening options and best practices. And so that's why we launched mybreastscreening.ca to help women navigate through those provincial programs and to advocate for better screening. And that brings us to our third advocacy stand, which is self-referral for women, for mammograms for women in their 40s. And we want women in their 40s to know that it is their decision whether or not to be screened. And we want them to know that the benefits of mammograms outweigh the harms. And we're just tired of this paternalistic narrative that women in their 40s shouldn't get mammograms because they may get anxious if they're called back for extra pictures. And we hear that same excuse used for women not to get ultrasounds for dense breasts. So the studies out there show that anxiety is transient. And we hear constantly that women would much rather be asked to return for extra pictures and have a cancer missed. The last thing I want to mention is that this past summer, we conducted a survey and 2,500 Canadian women answered questions about their breast screening experiences for us. And what we found was really disturbing. Just to give you a couple of findings, found that about 34% of women didn't feel that discussions with their healthcare provider about breast screening were adequate for their needs. And 11% of women aged 40 to 49 have been denied a requisition by their healthcare provider. And given that what I just said about the decision being a woman's, whether or not to be screened, no woman in Canada should be denied these mammogram requisitions. And after the survey, we published a report on the findings called Failing Canadian Women. And our report is a call to action for governments to ensure that every Canadian woman has an equitable chance to detect breast cancer as early as possible. And what we found interesting is that many of the issues that we're discovering in breast health, we know apply to other women's health issues. And BC Women's Health Foundation, they did a study that found 1 out of 2 women in BC felt dismissed by their healthcare practitioner. So we see not enough attention is being paid to women's health, and we feel Canadian women deserve better. Women's health is truly being interrupted. And so that's why we do what we do.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said that any better. And thank you so much, Jenny and Dr. Gordon, for the two of you for just being on Women's Health Interrupted. We feel so fortunate to have both of you here and advocating for such an amazing cause. So thank you to the two of you.
This episode got a few new synapses firing for you. Be sure to subscribe on whichever platform you get your podcasts to hear our episodes when they drop every second Wednesday each month.
Get in touch with us. We welcome any questions and constructive feedback.
You can email us at womenshealth.interrupted@ubc.ca
or find us on Twitter at @researchonwh
or on Instagram at @whrcluster.
To learn more about this topic, check out our show notes at womenshealthresearch.ubc.ca. We would like to thank the Michael Smith Foundation, BioTalent Canada, Patreon, and the UBC Global Lounge for their generous support of this project.
We would also like to thank the UBC Medicine Learning Network and its wonderful staff for hosting our podcast.
And a special thank you to Catherine Moore, who manages the Women's Health Research Cluster, for all of her work in the development of this initiative.
Thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful day or evening wherever you are, and please take care of yourselves.
Wishing you
good health.
Enjoying UBC Medicine Learning Network podcasts? Then you'll love our YouTube channel. Watch our award-winning medical educational media today at youtube.com/UBCMedVid. That's youtube.com/UBCMedVid. This has been a presentation of the UBC Medicine.
When you talk to your best friend, do you call me your girlfriend? Can we hang all fucking weekend? 'Cause I've been busy, but I'll take time for you. Time to miss me too. I'll
One half tiger cuff, one half bumblebee, one half I'm a Martian, one plus one equals three. The way they're looking at me's not even funny, believe. But I will sigh, then I sleep. I swear they don't want this beef. Oh girl, oh girl, oh girl, oh girl, oh girl, oh girl, oh girl. The past discovered running, the future surely coming, and present day's peripherals as iron bug, and missing what's in front of it. When did our lives become a blind spot? Toodles got lost cause he was desperate for reality and couldn't bear to live it inside his dreams. Finding foregone conclusions with infinite solutions. It's just like it sounds, that you're dumb and you're proud. You think an ounce of what you do could do a ting to my mood. Maybe the me from before, but now I'm him, thank the Lord. Still in progress, of course, but I smell like Dior, and I look like my mum and dad. Now what more could I want? Oh girl, oh girl.
To change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both! Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing health care, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder, because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well stop.
On January 17th, CITR 101.9 FM presents our annual 24 Hours of Radio Art programming, featuring innovative approaches to music and sound. It's 24 hours of spoken word, ambient, drone, field recordings, and sound walks, collage, technical support calls, voicemail fails, sound art, and noise. Listen live on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca.